Welcome to the Maine Science Podcast. I'm Kate Dickerson. Today's episode is a conversation I had with Lindsay Ware in late June 2022. Lindsay is the founder of Science Dogs of New England, which has a fantastic tagline, canine-powered conservation. Lindsay is a wildlife ecologist, and in 2011 merged her conservation work and ecology expertise with her other passion, dog training, and has been doing cutting-edge work ever since. Some of you might have been lucky enough to catch Lindsay when she presented at the 2022 Maine Science Festival event, Science Goes to the Dogs. We dive into that and more, and I think the work she's doing with her dog partners is fascinating and one of the coolest things I've learned about. I hope you get as much enjoyment from our conversation as I did. Well, great. Lindsay, welcome to the Maine Science Podcast. It is a pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
You have one of the coolest titles, jobs that I could think of, which is the Science Dogs of New England, right? Is your company. Mm-hmm. I think when most people think of dogs and tracking, they think of police dogs or other things, but you have gone a whole other route, which we'll get into. But before I let you dive into that, I was kind of hoping you could tell us how you got into science and then maybe how you got into the dog training part of it, because that is not necessarily a deep connection. I know you have a degree in biology, so that's a little bit of a leap from standard college biology into dog training.
Yes. So I've always been really interested in science, specifically environmental science and wildlife biology. So I kind of was one of these children that knew I'd be doing something to do with this ever since forever. I grew up around wildlife and exploring the outdoors. And as you said, my background educationally was in wildlife biology. And so that's after I grew up a little bit and I'm like, I'm going to study wildlife biology. And so that's what I did. And I was to be able to be a part of a lot of research projects, different research projects. I worked a lot of temporary jobs and kind of worked all around in different parts of US and Canada, actually, really learning about wildlife research. So I guess I got into dog training, which I also do consider a science, but just very different. And I got into it because I started kind of pinning myself down geographically and getting into more laboratory science than wildlife biology. So while I was really happy to still be in the field of science, I wasn't quite doing something I was like 100% passionate about within science. So I started getting really into training my dogs and learning about dogs and actually learning about the science of dogs and how they learn and what things drive their behavior and what other things that, you know, dogs are doing with us humans. So when I started learning more about dog training, I actually became a professional trainer kind of as my evening job after I worked in laboratory science. And just really, really enjoyed it. And then started getting into some of these extracurricular activities like tracking wounded game for hunters with my dogs that started connecting conservation and dogs.
Okay, before you go too far down that route, because that's that is one of the coolest parts. Would you mind explaining, you said you did a bunch of different wildlife ecology projects and works, and then you ended up in a lab doing different science, but still science. So what was the difference for you between those sets of sciences? And I will say, I also think dog training is a science as well. I think much like our own brain, we've only really scratched the surface of what we can learn and learn about animals in all sorts of ways. And the more I learn about dogs, and I would argue cats too, the more I'm convinced we've got a ton to learn from and about them. If you could just kind of explain, like, just for people who might not know, the difference between the ecology projects and then the lab part.
Sure. So the ecology projects were very applied projects where we were actually field technicians going out into different environments and collecting data from plants and animals in the wild. So some examples would be, I did one project about ruffed grouse habitat, and we were in these different plots where we were logging all the different species of trees and shrubs that were in the area and how dense it was and how it related to ruffed grouse habitat. I also did a lot of bird work, specifically with waterfowl. So we would trap waterfowl, put little colored markers on them and put leg bands on them so that we could then recapture them and use those numbers to try to estimate populations. So lots of different projects like that where we were doing, you know, hands-on field methods to collect data. the laboratory work was also doing different processes in order to collect data, but it was more in a controlled laboratory environment. So we were doing, some of it was actually doing services for other laboratories in relation to mouse models to help with learning more about human diseases. And I also had a couple of roles there where we were actually doing research and development. So we were doing all these experiments to try to make lab processes more efficient and be able to basically collect more data and be more efficient in our lab processes. Yeah. So, and I loved that actually. Like, while I wanted to be out there doing the applied stuff, I did start to fall in love with the methods part of the scientific method, right? Like that, like, oh, how do we collect data in a more efficient way? And how do we like do things so that we can do things better?
So do you think that what understanding methods and how to collect data to see what you're actually seeing may have helped you with dog training and moving on beyond what I would consider what most people think of for dog training, the minimum of what they can do? And this will be a really good opportunity to let the rest of the audience in on what it is you're doing with your dog, since we both know and they don't. But I'm wondering if the methods part helped with that, because you could look at it differently.
You know, that's really interesting. I've never really thought about it as helping. I've always thought about it as why I got into training and why I got into the work that I do now, because I just became so interested in like how to learn how to do things better and how to collect data more efficiently. But I guess also like looking at it from your perspective of like, yeah, like, did it help that? That's really interesting. Yeah, it's all interconnected, because if we want to segue into what I do now is I work with dogs in order to solve problems such as, oh, we're not collecting enough data in this research project, and we need to maybe find a different solution and a different method of detecting data, of finding the research subjects that we need, or of identifying those subjects. And the method that I specialize in now is something that we like to call scent detection, or more specifically, conservation detection. Scent detection, you already kind of mentioned some examples. Even if folks aren't familiar with that term, I think almost everybody is actually familiar with scent detection, whether they realize it or not, because it's things like narcotics detection, human remains detection, explosives. It's a very, very similar process. It's just that instead of detecting those things, the dogs that I work beside are detecting plants that someone is researching, or an animal, or they are searching for maybe evidence of that animal, such as scat samples.
I can totally see how your love of dogs and understanding dog training and then your life as a wildlife ecologist and biologist all merge with this. What I cannot figure out is how, and I suppose this is a problem with all dog training, but how do you identify a scent that's distinct enough for one plant that your pups can find it all the time?
Yeah, so a lot of times it's a little bit of a reliance on something very important that we know about dogs. And this very important thing that we know about dogs is that they are expert discriminators, which means they're really good at finding little differences in things. So that can be in things that they are witnessing visually, or it could be in things that they're smelling. They really tune into differences. In contrast, us humans, we tend to really gravitate towards generalization, which means like one thing that's kind of similar, we can kind of extrapolate that to something else. And that's a super important tendency to have. It really helps us out a lot. But that's not so much the dog's strength. They are geniuses at discriminating and at picking out little differences. And so when I train dogs just for like everyday life, like manners training, that's one thing that a lot of people really need to understand, is that we might be asking our dog to sit, and we might be actually giving them the signal to sit like slightly different than we normally do. And then when the dogs aren't doing the behavior, it's not because they're being stubborn or whatever. It's because like they're noticing a little difference in how we're doing it. And they're like, oh, well, that's not the same thing. And so it's kind of the same thing with scent. They could do this with scent where like, oh, well, this smells a little bit different than that. So this is actually isn't the thing that I want. I want this thing over here that smells exactly like the thing that I know that I'm going to get rewarded for.
That's really cool. I realized I cut you off when you said you started to get into game tracking. mm-hmm. which I'm going to assume is kind of the gateway into, oh, I could use these dogs for plants and animals. So mm-hmm. do I have that right? Is that how you got yeah. into this?
That's pretty much the way it happened. I got into that as a hobby and got really, really interested in it and started to see as the tracking, game tracking community started growing, we were making a really huge difference in conservation. And the whole time I was like really wanting to get back into the wildlife biology side of things. And at the same time, I was learning about this emerging field of conservation detection where, you know, although there's been some pioneers that have been doing it for quite a while, it really is coming more to the forefront now. And so we are considering it still very emerging. It just it, like something clicked. It's like, this is how I'm going to continue to make a difference in conservation and in science, but I'm going to, you know, do it differently. I'm not going to do this in laboratory science anymore. And I'm not going to do dog training as a separate thing. And I'm not going to, you know, I'm going to bring everything together.
So when you said you saw that the game tracking community was making a big difference in conservation, what do you mean?
Well, there are some circumstances that happen sometimes in hunting where, you know, an animal might be mortally wounded and it can't be found. And there's a whole host of reasons for this. It could be an accidentally misplaced shot. It can be weather conditions. It can be all sorts of things. This is something where we find that if we utilize dogs, work together with dogs that are really good at using their noses, they can be really effective in recovering animals that might otherwise not have been recovered. And of figuring out animals that aren't mortally wounded to figuring out that like, oh, okay, that animal is going to be okay. And then kind of giving some peace of mind to hunters. So that's kind of the two main functions. And the big conservation effort here is that we are, you know, harvesting those animals that could be harvested. So making a difference there where animals aren't being left out there. And it's really impactful in the conservation community and to the hunters and really making a difference. And it in the numbers that we do it across the country, it really makes a difference with preventing an animal being lost.
So when you were growing up, did you grow up in a place where you were regularly hunting yourself and had dogs helping out or not?
Well, I grew up with dogs, which is probably why I gravitate to them so naturally. And we did have a couple of hunting dogs growing up. My dad hunted, but I never hunted as a child. But we were very encouraged to be exploratory. And we played outside all the time. I was obsessed with catching frogs and, you know, checking them out and then putting them back in the pond, of course. But that is kind of the way that I was raised. And we came to Maine a lot and, you know, hiked up here and explored up here and everything. So yeah, it was like, you know, I'd never hunted, but I was just always fascinated by the natural world growing up and very much encouraged by my family to kind of explore that and pursue that.
Okay. So now that we have a broad sweep, I am not going to make you pick either your favorite animal companion or your favorite thing to track, but I do think it might be interesting for you to step us through how you would train one of your dogs for a specific project. You can pick a project or do a hypothetical, whatever's easier for you.
Okay. Probably if I pull in examples, I'll pull in from the biggest project that I work on, which is having to do with turtle detection. But just as a broad example, so there's kind of three main big parts to scent detection training for conservation purposes. And the first one is going to be, we want the dog to associate whatever that specific scent target is. So say, for example, it's a turtle, one specific species of turtle. We want the dog to associate that turtle with their favorite thing in the whole wide world. So the dogs aren't actually really caring about the turtle or the plant or whatever it is we're asking them to find. They really care about earning their very favorite thing. So for my detection dogs, their favorite thing, they're both toys. One of them really loves a tennis ball throw and the other one really loves to play tug. And so that is what they're working for. And other dogs might work for their favorite food treat. It just depends on what is like their number one top favorite thing. So that's the first big piece is like getting them to just associate that if I find this, I get my favorite thing. And then the second big piece of training is teaching them to do a specific behavior in order to communicate to us, hey, like I found the thing. And so now I get my reward. So come over here and give me my reward. And in the case of my dogs, they kind of freeze in place and point their nose towards whatever it is that they've found. we teach them that if they found a target, they don't get the reward until after they do that behavior. And then the third big piece is teaching the dog to search. And it seems a little silly because, like, well, of course a dog knows how to follow his nose and search, but there's a lot of complexities to tuning everything else out that's going on in the environment and dealing with any challenges, like the wind is really strong or it's swirling around and it's hard to pinpoint something. Like, those are all skills that a dog builds through training to be able to more efficiently go from, oh, just catching a whiff of something that they're going to be rewarded for, to actually working all the way to it and pointing out exactly where it is. So those are kind of the three big pieces of scent detection training. Of course, there's a lot to all three of those. And then we have a whole host of foundational behaviors that we train as well. That, for example, we need to make sure that dogs are safe while in the field. They have great, like, you know, recalls where they would come to us immediately when we ask them to, training to make sure that they're safe with wildlife, all sorts of great foundational things.
So you said your dogs, the way that they signal that they've found something, is that like dog specific and then you train them that they get what they want after that? Or do you have to train them to do that specific signal?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, because for me, I train it specifically, but one technique in this field is actually to wait to see what kind of behavior the dog offers naturally when they have found something and they're expecting a reward. And you can use your really good dog trainer timing and just time your reward to be like, okay, yeah, like keep offering that natural behavior. So for me, I ask for a specific behavior because the way that I do things, I want to leave myself open to whatever potential targets in the future I have researchers that might be interested in having me help find. And if it's something very fragile, like a, you know, endangered orchid or something that we want to make sure that the dog isn't going to disturb, I want to make sure that I have a behavior that involves the dog being very still and trying to prevent as much as possible any like accidental stepping or anything like that. So in dog training, you know, we like to think about behaviors that are incompatible with other behaviors. So for example, if you don't want your dog jumping on you, teach them to sit when they approach you. So same idea with detection, where I want to teach my dog something really incompatible with disturbing the whatever it is we're looking for. Because one of, I think, the amazing things about conservation detection is that it is a very non-invasive sampling method. And so our goal is always to not have much of an impact at all on the environment.
My other question is, let's say you do this turtle project and you're done, and your next project is a plant project. How hard is it to switch your dog's detection from one to the other?
So to teach them a new scent or an additional scent technically happens pretty quickly. These dogs, we specifically choose dogs that are incredibly motivated by their favorite things. So when you give them a new opportunity to earn that, they're like, okay, yeah, like they can memorize that scent very quickly. What takes time in preparing them for a new project is the fact that they might have to go about things a little bit differently. So is this new scent maybe something that might be up more at their head level or maybe even higher? And if you hadn't previously been, or have only been doing turtle stuff before that are always just on the ground or, you know, on the edge of the stream or something, then you do have to teach the dog to like use other strategies when they're searching. And some species and some targets have different concentrations of scent. Some can be really, really stinky, and some can be like, you might figure that a plant is not going to have a big, huge stench coming off of it, right? So that all comes into play when the dogs are searching. And so we do a lot of training to help them help themselves find it better. If it's something that's good, giving off low concentrations of scent, then we kind of have to teach them to maybe be a little bit more careful and meticulous and, you know, or search different. They definitely learn with practice of like, oh, like I should check this, like under this bush here, you know. And the dog I have that's doing a lot of the turtle work right now, like she, you can see her starting to understand like, oh, there's a big clump of grass. I should go check that. You know, she's not necessarily following a scent from there. She's just like, I'm going to go stick my face in here and see if I can smell anything. So they learn specific strategies for sure. And it's our job to help them learn that and to teach them that.
How long does it take to train the dogs? Like before they're ready to dive into the project, how long does it take to get them there?
Well, if you had a dog, like a dog that's already trained in scent detection, but you're going to take on a new project, it really depends. So you're going to, it's like the running joke when with conservation dog handlers is like, it really does. So I can give like a rough estimate of, in some cases, you could get a dog pretty operational in a few weeks. It depends. If you have a dog that already is trained on some kind of species of scat, then to do a different species of scat, a couple of weeks and you're probably good to go. If it's some kind of research subject that's very different, say you've never done live animal work, you've only ever done scat work or egg masses or something like that, or plants, it's just a little different if you're after, you know, live animals. So you're going to have to maybe prepare for a few months. It also depends on if you have a good available training, what we call training aids, which are samples of the scent that you have that you're trying to find. There's like a little bit of this tricky thing, conservation detection, where you're trying to find, often you're trying to find something that is dispersed very widely or rare. But in order to train the dogs to find that, you actually have to have it in the first place. And sometimes that can be really hard. And sometimes the samples that we're using to train the dogs on these rare items are actually not exactly what we're looking for. So for example, we might not have scat samples from a species from the wild, but we might be able to get some from captive situations. And those scat samples are going to smell a little differently because they're going to be eating different diets. So we're asking a lot of our dogs, actually. We are asking them to, as I was talking earlier about generalizing, we actually are asking them to do quite a bit of generalizing sometimes because we want them to like make that leap.
You're training them to do this really specific thing. And you just said, you know, that's their superpower basically, is being completely on target. One more very specific question. I'm assuming you cannot train a dog all day long for weeks. Like they need breaks. This sounds like it's actually really mentally challenging work in all the good ways. So do you build in, you know, like an hour here, an hour there during the day? And then there's that, maybe then you do the other foundational stuff and they just get to be dogs, for lack of a better phrase. I mean, how much can you really pound out the training with a dog per day?
You're right. We don't want to burn them out. And it is very mentally taxing for dogs to learn this stuff. Like generally, if I'm preparing for a project and I really am on a kind of a timeline, I'm not doing more than one session a day. Typically, I could do two if they were short, depending on what we were doing, but I would do a scent detection session. And then maybe if I had to do brush up on foundational work, you know, what we traditionally call obedience, then I could do a short session of that. But you're right, it's very mentally taxing and we don't want to burn the dogs out. And the other thing that sounds like maybe you're alluding to is when we're actually deployed and we're getting them to work, they are working for several hours. And that is not something that you can just go from a couple training sessions a day to be, okay, now we're going to sniff continuously for 4 hours. It's something that you need to build them up to physically, because we don't want them to hurt themselves. And we can't go from not having a lot of exercise to a lot of exercise. And we have to build it up mentally, gradually, so that they are, number one, not getting themselves burned out, but number two, not getting bored and or confused, because, you know, like we're asking them to search for something for 20 minutes in a controlled setting at the training facility. And then suddenly it's like, wait, now I'm supposed to sniff for 4 hours before I even find one of these things. So that is part of the training, is to build up that search stamina, you know, making sure that we're learning the dogs so we know when we need to give them breaks. And, you know, making sure that they stay happy and motivated. And there's so much to, you know, making sure they can do their jobs by kind of protecting them and making sure we're not setting them up to fail.
So I was lucky enough to sit in on your session at the festival this year in March. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting that I think surprised a lot of people in attendance was when you said there wasn't any particular breed that was particularly good at this, that it really was based on the reward system for the dogs and kind of their general temperament. Were you surprised by that when you first got into this specific scent training?
I don't know. I guess I wasn't, because through the tracking work that I had done before, like even though the work is very different, I draw so many parallels from that conservation tracking work for the large game. Like my first tracking dog was a mix, was a rescued mix from the shelter. And so you see all these different dogs doing it. So I guess I can say it didn't really surprise me very much. And a lot of the pioneering groups that I look up to so much. When I first started researching all this, they actually do a lot of dog rescue. And so they are looking for the individual and they're not really caring about the breed at all. You do sometimes see some breed patterns for sure, because some of these characteristics tend to pop up in certain breeds, but you know, you see all sorts of different breeds and mixes and sizes. And
how do you find a dog that you know what their number one thing is, right? Like, you know, mm-hmm. their motivator and you know, they're going to do the scent work really well. Is it just kind of like running them through stuff or
So like if I was going to find an adult dog, you would, different groups and different people have their own little tests of what they're looking for. There's certain things you can do to see how motivated a dog is for a certain thing. Like some groups will say like, yes, sometimes like the first round of checks is just like walking through kennels and bouncing a tennis ball and see who's paying attention to you, right? And there's all sorts of more formalized things you can do. And you know, what we're looking for is what's going to be the persistence level in that dog to get, you know, the ball or the food or the toy. And that's for an older dog. Now, if you're getting a dog from puppyhood, your strategy is going to be to look at the characteristics of that dog's pedigree and that dog's family. And you do want to use breed to a certain extent to that, because pretty much one of the big reasons pure breeds exist is because trying to get predictability in the dogs. So you're kind of taking that strategy, you know, that like, okay, I think I have a pretty good chance of getting a dog that I'm looking for based on these lines. Or you see dogs and you're like, okay, I'm going to figure out like that dog's pedigree and maybe get a dog from that line or something like that. So there's a few different kind of ways to go about it. And there's some really neat programs. Working Dogs for Conservation has a program where they have shelter groups do like formalized assessment to potentially evaluate certain dogs for a working situation, for a conservation detection situation. And it's win-win because those types of dogs don't want what we consider a normal pet home. Like they, you know, they're a little different and they have higher energy needs and really, really high drive to be out there working. And then it also helps identify what dogs might be able to have a career in detection work.
So you said it's a relatively new field and there's pioneers that you said you look up to. Where are the other big places that, I was going to say in the States, but I imagine it could be worldwide. Where are other groups doing similar work and how often do y'all get to see each other?
Well, so in the US, it's really emerging now. There's several groups now. Some of the pioneers are more out in the Western United States. So Working Dogs for Conservation and Rogue Detection Teams. There's a group now, the Conservation Dogs Collective, out in the Midwest area and surrounding states. And actually, it's a region of the world where it's very prominent, actually, is Australia. Australia has a lot of conservation detection groups. So it's really, really interesting. And as far as seeing each other, that sometimes can be kind of a tricky thing about it being a conservation detection handler, because even though there's like a lot of us out there, really in the grand scheme of things, there isn't. And sometimes you feel a little bit like, you know, a little isolated. And so a lot of us reach out, and especially over the last few years, there's been such a great push of this idea of community within this field. And I'm part of a group where we just have these Zoom meetings, and it's not really anything formal. It's just basically to touch base with the people in our field that we never really get to see face to face, or very rarely get to see face to face. I recently was at a conference this spring in New York, and we did a little session of conservation dogs presentations. And so I got to meet a few conservation dog handlers for the first time. And so we do what we can in order to try to network and to connect with each other, because we're a little spread out, you know, especially in the US. And
well, also by virtue of what it is you do, you need to be closer to wilderness to actually do your job, right? So you can't be all in the city to make this happen. So
that's true.
Like I said, I'm not going to ask you about a favorite project, but do you have a project or two that you were, I don't know, surprised, mystified, intrigued by, that you were able to make work that you weren't sure would happen? And I realize how vague everything I just said is, but.
Well, I don't know. I don't know about like mystified about making it happen, but I would love to talk about the turtle project that I'm involved in, because I've gotten really, really involved with it over the last few years. And actually, I think this is my fourth season working on it. So This is the Maine Wood Turtle Project, which is a long-term research project that's been going on in Maine through the Center for Wildlife Studies. And they were studying wood turtles before I ever got involved with them. But we started a collaboration almost four seasons ago now. And it was intended to be a little bit of like a trial because we searched the scientific literature and really couldn't find much about scent detection for this species of turtle called wood turtles. And they are a species of special concern here in Maine, and they're really interesting. So often we think about turtles and they're sitting in a pond, you know, sitting on a log or something like that. But these guys have a very large chunk of their life cycle in the terrestrial phase. So in the spring, summer, and early fall, they're going to be up in the uplands. And often once that vegetation moves in, they are really hard to see. They've got very cryptic coloring and they like to crawl in and be protected in the vegetation. So they get really hard to see. So we started this as kind of a trial thing, be like, let's try it out and, you know, see if this is something that maybe we could do. And it's really grown. And this is another great example of like scientific community where like we started this little collaboration. Oh, you know, maybe we could write a paper and then it kind of morphed into like, oh, you know, like let's, you know, teach some courses about this and let people know what we're doing. And, let's add this part of this project. Let's try to detect their nests, wood turtle nests. And so that's actually the part we're working on now. So it's really, really, really grown. So
how big do wood turtles get?
I don't know. The big males can be, I want to say like 10 inches long or so. Oh. Just kind of so, picturing it in my head. Maybe
pretty big, but super, like you said, cryptic coloring, so hard to find.
Yeah, for sure. And the little, and these are, you know, like a lot of turtles, these are a slow growing species. So, I mean, you have like a 10-year-old turtle that's like this big, you know, that's an adult and that's like a 25-year-old, you know, that big 8 or 10 inch turtle is like 20, 30, 40 years old, right? So yeah, the smaller juveniles can be very hard to find. And even the big ones, like I've had dogs alerting, which is what we call like that behavior to like, hey, it's right here, or an indication. And we'll be like, I don't see anything. And the dog's like, it's right here. And it's just amazing how much they can blend in. They have cryptic coloration and they're really good at wedging themselves into hiding spots. And you can be looking right at it and be like.
So as part of this project, both identifying numbers, but also the ideal habitat for them?
Well, we keep adding things every year.
Well, yeah, I just realized as I asked it, I was like, she said we keep adding things.
So I think it started, so back when Dr. Cheryl Frederick and Dr. Matt Chatfield started this project, I think it was focused more on population dynamics. They were doing a technique called capture, mark, recapture, which means they mark the turtles in some way. And then they use that data when their turtles are recaptured to help estimate the populations. And they also, aside from just marking and then hopefully recapturing them, they also did some telemetry. So they would put a radio transmitter on a subset of them, and every week they're relocating them to find out about their movements. They've always had an element of studying habitat on that, but there's been much more of this because, like many species, their, you know, habitats are disappearing. So what we're really trying to understand is really what's the most important features of these turtles as far as habitat goes on a big scale and also on a little micro scale, little micro habitat scale, where are they going to bask? Where are they going to lay a nest? What's the most important thing for them? So they are really doing a great job right now of trying to dive deep into some of those questions.
And you said one of your dogs has been doing this. Has she been on the project the whole time?
No. So we did a trial season project in 2019. That was just kind of like, is this something that we should pursue? And so we did that with one dog, her name's Delta. Things went really, really well. And then the next year is when I added my dog Chili Bean into the group. And with Chili Bean, what we decided to do is because we were really interested in publishing and like sharing what we were learning about detection dogs for wood turtles with other conservation groups and other conservation dog groups, is that we were really interested in exploring like, how do we really document and assess this training in a really detailed and scientific way through the very beginning? And so we had this new dog on board. She's completely green. She was a young, you know, 4 or 5 month old puppy. So we saw this great opportunity to completely document like the building of a turtle dog, right? So that was Chili Bean. And so we put her through this process, really laid out a detailed assessment. Like, how do you know a dog is ready to be in the field? How do you know some of these questions that we want to answer about training and assessing a dog and making sure they're ready? So we did all that with Chili Bean. And we also found through working with both dogs that there's this phenomenon of project matching with dogs. So there's some species that, and some types of projects that might be well suited to one dog versus another. And Chili, because we had working such with a large area with this project, she was really, really well suited for this. So she's now become the primary wood turtle dog. Whereas Delta I use for more like very more detail oriented projects where the, you know, things are very, very small and you need to really sniff very, very carefully and not so fast.
I love that you're doing two different kinds of science with this project, right? So you're doing the turtle science and then you're doing dog science to figure out. That's so cool. I did not expect that actually.
We have a really cool group of people on this project where, you know, it's a mix of herpetologists. And then we also have one of the co-founders of the project, the co-PIs. She actually has a background in, Dr. Frederick, she has a background in training zoo animals. And so the team itself, even before I got involved, have this cool mesh of, you know, applied wildlife research and animal training and, you know, in zoos. And, you know, if you really delve into animal training in zoos, this is where a lot of this comes from, where they're really big into the assessment and the documentation and, you know, of the training process. So we're kind of drawing on all sides here with that. It's neat.
So how much work are you able to do with the conservation dog scent part in the winter?
My winters are busier than I always think they should be. I'm always like, winter, this is my time to relax. But there's so much continued education. Like, I've always felt like this about dog training. I've been a professional dog trainer since 2011 or so. And it's like, I'm never, ever going to stop having a learning curve. It's just all the time. And that's how it's always going to be with anything I do, the tracking training, the detection training. So that takes place a lot in the winter. There's a lot of grant proposal writing and making sure that data is entered. And there's just so many things to do in the winter, you know, maintenance training with the dogs, making sure they're staying sharp, making sure they're staying fit, because you don't want them to get out of shape in the winter and then hurt themselves come spring when you're asking them to do more physically. Yeah.
So there's no break. Okay.
there is with like the physicality of going out in the field.
Sure. Yeah, for sure. But there's not like you're kicking back, reading a book with the fireplace for weeks at a time.
No.
How many dogs do you have doing this right now? Is it just those two?
So right now I have one tracking dog that's specifically just, he only does wounded game tracking. And I've got two dedicated scent detection dogs.
And do you think that's about the limit as one person to three dogs on three very different, you know, you said one, well, the tracking dog, and then you said the scent detection, one is, you know, wide, big areas, and one is much more detailed. Like, you're being taxed at all of those levels too. How much more could you possibly do as one person?
Well, I guess we'll find out.
Okay.
No, it's a lot. Like, you have to, you know, the more dogs you add to a program and don't add more people, you're stretching yourself over the dogs and you don't want to neglect anything or anybody as far as it, when it comes to dogs. So yeah, it's definitely a lot. And it depends on how young they are too, you know, the younger dogs. I'm just getting out of a time where I had like my three dogs I have now are not very different in age and they were kind of young. And so, you know, as they're getting more proficient and it's getting a little bit easier, and I will be adding another tracking dog within the next year or two, because you don't want to put everything on one dog because you don't want to put too much physical pressure on them. And you know, you want to make sure that you're playing to each dog's strengths and weaknesses, like with the scent detection example. Same thing with tracking. We actually just recently lost an older dog, and when he tracked wounded game, and then I had my current primary tracking dog, it's really neat because we could like find out information about the tracking situation and then make decisions about which dog to use based on their strengths and weaknesses. So that is really helpful. But yeah, it's a lot of work. Dogs are a lot of work for sure.
Yeah, it's like an eternal two-year-old all the time. So I meant to ask you early in our conversations and I realized I didn't. You said you used to visit Maine. So where did you grow up?
I grew up in Connecticut.
Oh, in Connecticut. Okay. Yeah. So in one of the few wilderness parts of Connecticut, or one of the more what we all think of when we think of Connecticut?
I would say it's not what we all think of when we think of Connecticut. It was Eastern Connecticut.
Oh, yeah.
We were in a rural like environment. We had woods in the back of our house that we would play in. But I also kind of felt the wanting to go to other places that have, like, you know, we always went to Maine, and that's where my parents like to go for, you know, hiking and camping and things like that. So I got to experience a lot of different places for kind of outdoor activities. But yeah, I grew up in Connecticut.
So last one question that I can think of for now, and then you'll be off the hook. Did you pick coming back to Maine? Because you said you were all over the place and then you settled in a lab. Was it because you wanted to come back to Maine, or was it just luck and good fortune?
Well, I always had that in the back of my head. I just never thought that I would be able to, because, you know, often when you're in biology or wildlife biology, you know, you have to go where you need to go. And if your career is a priority, then sometimes you're going to be open to that. But I ended up in Maine. My significant other is in fishery science. So he was fortunate enough to get work here. And so that's why we ended up coming here. And he's from Maine originally. So it worked out great, because I always wanted to. I just come back here, but I just didn't, you know, I didn't want to make it like a requirement.
My husband and I grew up in, I was upstate New York and he was Western New York, and we lived in Providence, and he's an academic. So you go where the jobs are, right? Mm-hmm. You don't get to pick. And position to open up at the University of Maine for him. And we felt like we won the lottery. Like, we never, ever thought we'd get back in New England. You know, when he interviewed for the job, we were in West Michigan, totally far from everywhere we'd ever been. So I totally get it.
Yeah, we were in Ontario when he interviewed for here, and we ended up close to his family here, which is...
What a score.
Yeah.
Lindsay, this has been a delight. I feel like I've learned a lot more about dogs. I grew up as a cat person, but what I really like about dogs is other people's dogs. Like, it's kind of like being the aunt. It's great. there's things that you said that really struck with me. You know, you want to reward behavior based on what you don't want. So I was thinking, you know, the trampling, you don't want that with the animals. And it's really cool. It's a really cool way to think about your work in this project level, and how you have to think about all these different pieces to make sure you get the end result and keep everybody happy. Cause you're not just moving like furniture around here. You've got other living creatures you've got to worry about. It's just really neat stuff. And I think Maine is really lucky to have a pioneer in this field. I think the work that you do is super fascinating. And I think an awful lot of people are going to be excited to know that there's this opportunity. If you love these two worlds, you can have them collide like you've done.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the Maine Science Podcast. Make sure you never miss an episode by subscribing on your podcast platform of choice. And please leave a rating and review. It will help more people find us and help spread the word about some of the remarkable people doing science in Maine. The Maine Science Podcast is recorded at Discovery Studios at the Maine Discovery Museum in Bangor, Maine. The Maine Science Podcast is hosted by me, Kate Dickerson. This episode was edited and produced by Scott Lozell. We receive financial support from Central Maine Power, production support from Miranda Bouchard, and social media support from Next Media. The Discover Maine theme was composed and performed by Nick Parker.